Morning, everybody. On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. Baltimore is a city of renters. Of the 622,000 of us who live here, more than half of us rent rather than own our homes. The majority of renters are low income. A new report from the Public Justice Center indicates that problems with renting, evictions, and fees are systemic. And many of those problems are with what's known as rent court. We're going to take a close look at the Baltimore rent court with the author of the Public Justice Center report and an attorney who leads a team representing tenants. Plus, theater critic Jay Wynn Russick reviews the latest production at the Fells Point Corner Theater and the music of Sweet Sarrow. They'll talk with producer Jonna McCone about the sonic experience of recording an album in a home in rural Maryland. Nathan Sterner has the local news. We'll start with the national headlines.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Hope you had a good weekend. Baltimore is a city of renters. Of its 622,000 or so residents, more than half rent rather than own their homes. The majority of those renters have a median income of less than $28,000 a year. Thousands of families and individuals every year have problems that are unique to renters. How to best communicate with their landlords, getting repairs done thoroughly and in a timely way, getting their deposits back, and in many cases, avoiding eviction. Thousands of landlords, from major companies to mom-and-pop entrepreneurs, rent apartments and row houses on the open market and through the Housing Choice Voucher Program as well. Today, the Public Justice Center is releasing a report that indicates that there are often serious systemic problems between renters and landlords. The report focuses on how Baltimore's rent court runs and operates. This morning, we're going to look at this unique court with the main author of that report, Zafar Shah. He is the attorney at the Public Justice Center's Human Right to Housing Project. Good morning. It's good to meet you.
It's good to be here, Tom.
I was amazed when I read this report. First of all, the sheer volume of what happens in this place, 150,000 cases adjudicated in a year, 600 to 1,000 cases per day. And that's actually better. That you write that it's improved from the 90s when it was 3,000 cases.
That's right.
How does anybody make sense of that many cases in a day and in a year?
It's a huge challenge, not just for the affected population of renters, poor renters, like you mentioned, but for the court system itself, court administrators and judges. They've struggled for years to try to figure out how to handle this volume. The volume of cases is really a function of our law, our summary ejectment law, which is in our state code as well as our city public local law. So over the years, the rent court, the district court, has created this rent court docket. They've tried different ways to reduce really the stress on the judges in the docket. One of the points of emphasis in our report is to focus on how efficiencies which the court system is using to handle this volume really overwhelm due process and end up diverting renters away from defending themselves and towards informal resolutions which don't actually treat or solve the underlying problems in their housing situation.
Was the idea of establishing a rent court to begin with to segregate those cases from the regular cases at the district court? I mean, you know, civil suits and criminal cases and traffic violations or whatnot. I mean, did it seem like a good idea at the time? Because this goes way back. I mean, the rent court was established like in the 40s or something, right?
In the 40s with the Baltimore Plan, which was, the city's policy to rid the center city of slums. That plan involved creating a housing court in which the city could aggressively enforce code against slumlords. And so the housing court at that point was really dealing with the city prosecuting and trying to get rid of those problem properties. But there's a trade-off there. If you're bringing landlords to court at the same time in that time period in legal history, you have a turn away from self-help eviction towards this summary ejectment process.
What does self-help eviction mean?
So self-help was really the common law idea that the landlord owns the property. So they have the superior right to the property. And when they have a problem with their landlord, you know, there's no contractual rights or obligations. They act swiftly to get the tenant out of the property. Self-help just meaning they did it themselves. Lockouts, you know, what have you. That put a lot of tenants in jeopardy, obviously. So the legal solution at that point in the middle of the 20th century is to create summary proceedings, which just means a really informal hearing in which rules of evidence, need not apply. There's sort of an informal adjudication where the judge is more of an inquisitor. There's not witnesses in evidence and that kind of thing. That gave landlords the ability to turn to the court system, this more uniform system, to quickly get a tenant out of the property. In our state, we've had a 5-day period between a landlord filing for an eviction and the court hearing the case. At certain times, earlier than even the 50s, it was just 2 days.
And we should mention that in other kinds of cases that are not in rent court, that period is usually about 2 weeks, right? 15 days, something like that. So it's much shorter. It's much more attenuated in rent court than it is for another kind of legal procedure.
Yeah. So for instance, a breach of lease case would take a month to get to trial. This case will be heard in a week. And there could be a warrant to enforce an eviction issued in just 2 weeks after the landlord files the case. So housing court began with the code enforcement issue. It had to accept that landlords are going to use housing court for their own needs. And the whole court has been overtaken. District court.
Yeah, so now that balance is very much on the side of the landlords.
It very much is.
It started with the state or individual renters suing their landlords for, you know, degradation of their property or whatever the problems were. Mm-hmm. Now the overwhelming majority of cases are landlords against tenants, right?
It really is. It's the most prevalent type of litigation in the district court system, not only in Baltimore City, but the entire state.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm speaking with Zafar Shah. He's the main author of a new report released just this morning by the Public Justice Center. It's called Justice Diverted, How Renters Are Processed in the Baltimore City Rent Court. Give me a sampling of the kinds of cases that rent court adjudicates.
Well, these are all initiated by a landlord who's claiming that there's a dispute about payment of rent. What we see at Public Justice Center, we're a civil legal aid organization. We see, maybe 600 tenants a year. That's a tiny slice of how many are summoned to court. We see cases where the landlord is misallocating monthly rent payments to other types of charges, not just the rent, but agent fees, repair costs, almost anything that they want to deem a collectible as rent. There are a lot cases involving housing habitability. The underlying issue of the fair bargain, you're paying your rent for a quality or at least meeting code type of apartment or house. That issue should be part of every rent case, even by our local laws. But it's hard to get that in front of a judge, and our report details why that is.
Yeah, and one of the things your report talks about is the fundamental difficulty that renters have navigating the process of rent court. Our producer, Jonna McCone, was at rent court a while back, and she spoke to this gentleman. He's a boyfriend of a tenant whose name is Ms. Myers, and he described her experience.
Ms. Myers is educated, a high school graduate, but with dealing with the legal system, most people, black people as well as any ethnic group, you get intimidated by authority. So I'm here for more support and to explain it the best way I can and articulate for us as well as I can.
So you also write in this report that oftentimes renters are not represented by legal counsel. You mentioned that you at the Public Justice Center represent about 600 cases a year, but there are 600 cases a day coming in front of the
That's
court.
Right.
But they have no lawyers, but the landlords have people also who aren't lawyers, but the law allows these other people to be involved. Who are they?
There is an exception in Maryland law on the bar to unauthorized practice of law. And that exception allows landlords in rent cases in rent court as well as in rent escrow cases in the housing court to use virtually anybody to represent them as a non-attorney stand-in in court. It could be personnel of their corporation. It could be a friend. It could be someone the tenant has never met. And that poses a significant problem in a contested case where one party, the tenant, has a lot of personal knowledge of their case, but the person bringing the case for the plaintiff has no knowledge. The court system puts a lot of trust in these non-attorney representatives, landlord agents, to negotiate informally without any arbiter, also to iron out contested facts so that the judge doesn't have to spend the time to do it. But who are landlord agents? Many of them don't even work for a management company. They are simply hired guns, really operating as a collection or debt management type of service. There's companies like ClickNotices.com, eRit, MyRentCourt.com. These folks operate in high volume so that they can get a lot of cases, bring them together. They take, you know, $10, $15 or something out of each landlord's case, file the case, stand in court, and really they're there in the court system to create an efficiency. So for the 1,000 cases in each docket, you know, only a couple, maybe 100 will actually become contested cases in front of a judge.
And this is what you're saying, how these efficiencies can often just simply run roughshod over the rights of the renters. Safra Shah is the lead author of a study published today by the Public Justice Center called Justice Diverted, How Renters Are Processed in the Baltimore City Rent Court. Joining us now is Deborah Weimar. She joins us on the phone from her home here in Baltimore. She's a professor at the University of Maryland School of Law. She works with law students there in a clinic where students are representing tenants. Deborah Weimar, welcome to the show. Nice to have you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So, Deborah, the Public Justice Center's report surveyed nearly 300 renter court defendants. 78% reported at least one threat to health or safety in their homes when they ended up in rent court. Is this your experience in the clinic that you and the students at University of Maryland are running?
Yes, absolutely. It's a huge problem in Baltimore City and unfortunately has been a problem for many, many years. And it's only getting worse as the access to, quality, affordable housing is becoming more difficult. We've seen a number of cases involving lead paint, mold, flooding, those kinds of conditions that have posed a risk to children and their parents.
And Zafar Shah and I were talking in the first part of the show today about how most of the time tenants do not go into rent court with legal representation. So they're often unaware of possible defense strategies that they could employ. And the fact that some of these landlords are allowing the homes to be degraded and the issues of habitability would suffice as a defense for many of these tenants. Do I have that right?
Absolutely right. Yeah, there's very little access to counsel for people. That's one of the reasons I set up this clinic, is to both provide a little bit of help, but also to educate law students about the tremendous need that there is in our community that's not being met.
And Zafar Shah, it's a sort of a vicious cycle that really does a lot to create homelessness. I mean, 7,000 to 8,000 people are evicted every year in Baltimore City for lack of payment of rent. Your report points to the cycle of these people being evicted for failure to pay rent. Matter of fact, many of the tenants, I guess, are a brought-to-rent court multiple times. I mean,
that's
the,
right.
The ratio is something like 3 cases for every rental unit in the city. So the landlords really are using this aggressively.
The system is set up to incentivize repeat filings, and they can be brought as soon as possible. The first day that a tenant is late on the rent, a filing in court can be done, and the summons to a court case is sometimes the first notice that a tenant has that there is rent in dispute. The habitability problem often leads to renters who are typically poor, making less than $2,000 a month. They have to make trade-offs between paying the rent and other essential parts, affording other essential parts of their life. Medicine, other types of health care, education costs, other debts that they might have, that kind of thing. If there is some housing issues, some conditions issue, which is neglected by the landlord, tenants face having to take what they can afford for everything else in their life and the rent, and having to afford their own repairs, their own types of fixes, whatever alternative, remedy they can come up with. Losing that kind of money month to month really causes people to be in a position not to be able to defend a rent case. They face the pressure of the eviction and have to quickly probably leave their property. And then the only alternatives they have at that point are other substandard low-cost housing. And so they jump from one bad situation to the next.
Mm-hmm. And Deborah Weimar, as you represent these people in rent court, is the fact that they simply can't afford the rent because they've got other financial obligations, food and clothing and other things, transportation, is that in and of itself a defense?
No, unfortunately not. Certainly not. I feel like it should be, but the way our law is structured, basically the property owner is entitled to their money, and the circumstances of the tenant are simply not considered. But the problem is even worse than that, even putting that aside, which would be a great thing. In some countries, there's actually a right to housing, and it's considered in a different way than we consider it here. But even in the situations where the tenants do have a good defense, as Zephyr was alluding to, the judges often simply don't assist the tenants at all, and sometimes even make it very difficult for them to raise those defenses. So, for example, many of the judges basically feel like the tenant has to show that they can pay the full amount of the rent before they're even allowed to raise their concerns about the leaky windows and the flooding and the various health hazards that are in the apartment. And that's something that the law has tried to address, and that I think this report will be helpful in perhaps nudging the court to do more to look at what they can do to basically facilitate fair representation for both sides in these cases.
Deborah Weimar is on the faculty of the University of Maryland School of Law. She works with law students there in a clinic representing tenants in rent court. She joins us on the phone. Zafar Shah is with me here in the studio. He's an attorney with the Public Justice Center's Human Right to Housing Project. He's the lead author of a report released today, Justice Diverted, How Renters Are Processed in the Baltimore City Rent Court. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Zafar, we tried to get a landlord to come on the show, and we had trouble finding anybody willing to speak on the record. Our producer, John McCone, did speak with the landlord on background, who says that the major issue as he sees it is that tenants are simply failing to prioritize rent. And he brought up the example of evicting somebody who was behind on the rent who had this massive big screen TV. So they're spending money on the TV and they're not spending money on the rent. How do you respond to that kind of perspective?
Well, I think he's addressing individual anecdotes. There's a psychology of poverty that he's referencing, in which short-term gains, like a material asset gaining that, helps someone cope with the other instability in sort of short-term outlook they have because of their financial situation. But that's really overlooking the systemic issue, and that's what we've tried to focus on in this report. There are structural issues here in our housing policy, which has placed really the burden of enforcement of housing habitability on the court, which is in no place, you know, they're in no position to actually be able to enforce it because of the way our summary judgment law works. I think that landlords don't take seriously their legal requirement to provide housing which is up to code. There's also just a profit-driven motive there. And for many landlords, I can reasonably understand that they're small-scale owners, landlords, and they have to cover certain capital costs. But at the same time, in that bargain for rent, there's a lot of services landlords do have to cover, which they strategically don't, often for financial reasons.
And Deborah Weimar, would you think, a lot of folks say that the people, the landlords, are using the rent court essentially as a collection agency, and that that's not an appropriate function for a governmental body. What's your...
Well, unfortunately, I actually do go to court quite a bit with my students and have new students every year going to the court. And that's certainly the impression that everybody comes away with, that because basically the judge is up there and says, okay, did you pay the rent or not? And that seems to be the only issue often that the judges are willing to consider. And so the tenant certainly would get that impression that that's the purpose of the court, and I think part of the reason for that is because the landlords are often represented in these cases either by a lawyer or by an agent who's used to doing this work.
Right, we talked about that.
Whereas the tenants are almost never represented.
They're
never represented. So when we go to court with the tenant, then we have a whole different kind of hearing,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's a huge problem.
I mean, is there a better way to do it? Is rent court simply, is this something we should just nuke and start over? Or are there fixes to rent court that we could implement that would make it fairer?
Right. Well, I think that's part of what the Public Justice Center is looking at, and we're looking at as well. There are a lot of people in the community that are concerned about it. I think at the basic level, enforcing the rights that tenants already have on the books would be a good step in the right direction. But it's clearly not going to solve all of the problems that exist. There is
And
it's
what,
a huge
what specifically?
Problem that people can't afford rent, and even working poor people, you work and get a minimum wage job, you're not going to be able to afford, as Zephyr was saying, all of your expenses.
Yeah,
and we're not just talking about flat screen TVs, we're talking about, and though I talk to my students about that too, that may be the entertainment somebody has. They're not spending money on anything else. Right.
But what statutes in particular do you think are not enforced that could be enforced to strengthen the
For example, landlords are supposed to register, both with regard to just generally register as landlords, and then also with regard to lead paint. Anybody with housing built before a certain year, I believe now it's 1978, is supposed to register. And according to the PJC's investigation, that's being not even half of the landlords are abiding by those restrictions. So that's huge. So enforcing those kind of rules, like we've seen just in the last year, we had a couple of cases involving lead paint where the landlords were not following their obligation, and I'm concerned we're going to have another whole wave of poisonings like happened years ago. It got better because of advocacy and new laws, but now if the laws aren't being enforced, the housing stock in Baltimore City is old and deteriorating, and the lead paint is still there.
Yeah, and of course, here this week, with the Freddie Gray trials going on, both Mr. Gray and Officer Porter, who's currently on trial as one of the six officers charged in his death, both showed evidence of lead poisoning as children. I mean, this is an endemic problem across the city. Obviously, Zafar Shah, this is, all taken up with the large, complex issue of housing and housing insecurity that so many poor people have. But are there things about rent court that, could be salvaged and would be good? And what are your basic recommendations for moving forward?
Well, one that Professor Weimar touched on is the compliance of landlords with regulations that they have to abide by in order to rent their property. We found that not even a third of landlords had provided the court with valid information supported by Baltimore Housing about their registration and licensing status. Barely 20% of landlords had provided valid information supported by Maryland Department of Environment about their lead risk reduction compliance. So they're coming to court largely with unclean hands and asking to use the court system to evict people. only a third of our respondents in this survey said that they lived in a apartment complex. That means that by and large, most tenants at Rent Court live in small scale properties, which are often not considered multifamily. And so they're not even required to be licensed at Baltimore Housing. So there's no annual inspection that has to happen. We propose that we change the city code to have a blanket rental licensing for every rental, whether it's one unit or 100, whatever it is. Every landlord should be passing an inspection every year and have a license from that inspection. Moreover, we have to cut down the number of cases. 150,000 cases a year is not only excessive, but it's unnecessary. Most cases can resolve themselves within 2 weeks. We know that because only half of that 150,000 end up with a writ to enforce a judgment for possession. So we propose a 14-day waiting period before a landlord can file a case. They need to present.
It's currently 5 days, right?
There's currently no waiting period.
Well, like I said, they can do it immediately.
They, as soon as they want to, without any written demand to the tenant, they can file. We think there should be a written demand, a 14-day period in which the landlord has to provide documentation of the dispute, an accounting statement, which is required by state law anyway. And so that can cut down the volume. We want to see judges more strictly apply the law, which is to say that they need to hold landlords to their burden.
Right.
Make them provide the evidence to build their case. But finally, Tom, one of the most important things is that whatever you do with the court system, you have to solve the fact that tenants come in, 50% of them don't know anything about their basic defenses. 72% of renters in our study didn't know this basic defense that they can ask the court to escrow their money in a court account while the court orders repairs.
Deborah Weimer, as you were saying, the fundamental problem here is that a lot of folks just don't have the money to pay the rent. And one of the solutions that various jurisdictions enact is that there's, you know, government money used to help people avoid eviction. And the argument, obviously, is that, you know, if the city or the state doesn't intervene and help people avoid being kicked out of their house, they just create another homeless family.
And the cost of homelessness, that's a really interesting point, because I think in New York City right now, they're recognizing that the cost of homelessness in New York City is so tremendous that it's actually fiscally sound to provide representation to at least a substantial number of tenants in court to make sure their defenses are appropriately raised and to reduce the number of evictions, that actually makes financial sense.
Here's a comment from a woman. Not all of these disputes are simply about, you know, you haven't paid the rent. Here's a comment from a woman that Jonna McCone, our producer, spoke with, who says that her landlord has retaliated against her because she failed to do something illegal that he wanted her to do.
He wanted me to get a green card for a friend of his. You know, nobody wants to touch that story. Nobody. But I'm not getting involved with stuff like that. And that's where it started off, with the stupid coin. Because I won't do it. So I've been asking him to work on my houses and stuff like that so we can live in it properly. Because I just gave him money to hold the property till I moved down here. I didn't really look at it, but then when I realized it needed a lot of work done to it, I did majority of work, me, my kids, and other people to help me. And then there were certain things I couldn't do, I had to get an inspector to do it. Well, now that I had to do that, he's mad at me and he's telling me I had to leave. And I've been paying him extra because I've been trying to avoid all this drama because of the illegal stuff that he wanted me to do. I'm raising two kids that don't have parents that passed away. So basically, he's taking advantage of me and my kids.
We heard about the Gilmore Homes in Baltimore Public Housing in which maintenance workers were demanding sexual favors from residents before they made repairs. This seems to be an endemic issue in Rent Court. Deborah Weimer, is this an experience you've had as well?
Not in terms of the sort of sex for, you know, for work kind of demands that are being made, which are just terrible. I have not heard that. I've certainly heard lots of situations where tenants were taken advantage of by the landlord's You know, for example, like she was describing, that they would come in and the tenants would come in and fix up the place, and then the landlord would find some, you know, excuse after a few months to evict them and never compensate them for the work that they had done. That sort of thing definitely happens.
Well, Deborah Weimar, thank you so much for your time. Zafar Shah, appreciate it. We're going to make this report available to folks, and we will follow up with this as this story continues. But as we say, this is also completely integrated with education, jobs, food insecurity, housing insecurity, part of the complex of issues that our city faces. All right,
absolutely.
Thanks to you both. Zafar Shah from the Public Justice Center. Deborah Weimar is on the faculty of the University of Maryland School of Law. The Public Justice Center report on the Baltimore rent court is being released today. We'll have a link to a copy of the report on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up after a break for news, our weekly theater review from Maryland Morning theater critic Jay Wynn Russick. She'll tell us about the new show at the Fells Point Corner Theater, and we'll be introduced to the music of a local band, Sweet Sorrow. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Theater critic Jay Wynn Russick joins us most Monday mornings here on Maryland Morning. This week, she reviews the new show at the Fells Point Corner Theater in Baltimore.
The title of the bold new play at Fells Point Corner Theater is a provocative monosyllabic word not suitable for public radio. In polite company, Mike Bartlett's award-winning drama has come to be known as the cockfight play. And though cockfighting isn't mentioned in the script, at Fells Point Corner, director Steve Goldklang has clearly been inspired by it. Two roosters ready for combat are painted on the back wall of designer Roy Steinman's bare set. A large dark red ring is painted on the floor. In addition, Goldklang begins many scenes with a bell that sounds like the start of a prize fight round. But unlike prize fights, or cockfights, there are three sparring characters: a man, identified simply as M, a woman, identified as W, and John, who is sleeping with both the man and the woman. David Shoemaker plays John with boyish charm. Donald Charles plays the man as manipulative, a bully. The two men have been in a long-term relationship when John suddenly announces he's become involved with a woman.
I think I'm in love and I need help because she's mad.
Bang! There it is. Love? Mad? She?
John's inability to decide between the man and the woman makes up the plot of the cockfight play. No subplots, just a lean look at a modern-day romantic triangle. The writing is taut and sharp, qualities well realized by director Goldklang's skilled cast and striking staging. A strong warning: the play contains profanity and sexual content. There's no nudity, though. The director uses mere suggestion when the characters undress, as well as when they eat or drink. In the final scene, when a dinner brings the three principals together, along with the man's father, the actors circle the seating area like a game of musical chairs. It's an apt visual metaphor for the plot. John, however, doesn't care where he winds up or with whom. He simply drifts into situations. That's how he got together with the woman. Portrayed by Barbara Madison Hauk, this character is as assured as John is unsure.
Would you consider sleeping with a woman?
I see.
Well?
That's...
Yes?
I see.
It's just a question, please.
But while John drifts into things, he has no idea how to drift out. And no idea what he wants, except, perhaps, not to be forced to choose and not to be labeled. As John becomes more indecisive, he becomes more unsympathetic. Knowing who you are is an attractive trait. Refusing to know sets everyone, including the audience, on edge. British playwright Mike Bartlett has written a play as sparse and raw as, well, a pair of fighting roosters in a cockfight. Bartlett is also the author of the acclaimed larger-scale drama King Charles III, which opened on Broadway last month. Kudos to Fells Point Corner for introducing Baltimore to this important young writer, a writer with a gift for making theatergoers as uncomfortable and involved as the characters on stage.
Theater critic J. Wynn Russick, you can catch the show at the Fells Point Corner Theater until December 20th. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. Stay with us. Now, we want to take a listen to the Baltimore-based band Sweet Sarrow. They released a self-titled EP back in September. Lead singer Abby Becker and drummer Adam Scott Farkas sat down with our producer, Jonna McCone, to talk about their work.
My name is Abby Becker, and we are Sweet Sarrow, a Baltimore Americana band. I sing and I play guitar, a little bit of fiddle, and I write the music.
And my name is Adam Farkas, and I play the drums for Sweet Sarrow.
And we play music about dreams. So I grew up classically trained, and I grew up in West Virginia playing klezmer music, which is Eastern European traditional folk music. And so I don't think that reads so much into what we play, except in terms of my sense of time. So there's always this kind of wait and delay.
It's kind of a constant expanding and contracting of the time that evens out to a consistent tempo.
It gives us this very expanding and contracting sense of the music, which is really dynamic. And that feeling and the emotion is something that's really important. I spend a good amount of time saying, we're going to play this song, and just imagine that you're having a really nice waltz. And so you can really imagine, you know, when in the dance you would pick up your feet and come back to the ground. And that gives us, first of all, a lot of movement, and also the emotion starts to read so people can connect to it. To really drill down into the essence of something where you really can't hide, and if it's bad, it's bad, but if it's good, it's so good.
I wouldn't call us a folk band, but I think we get kind of lumped into that because of the attitude with which we approach music as individual musicians playing together, and there's a lot of openness with that and collaboration and bringing people in for things and trying different things and all the different instruments that everybody plays. It gives us a lot of options.
The name comes from an old British folk ballad called Pretty Sarrow, which is a really beautiful song about lost love and actually losing the one you love, and he's searching for a pretty sarrow and he can't find her. When I first came to this country in 1849, I saw many fair lovers. We just released our self-titled album. The writing process was longer, but we took about a year to record it. And we went out to our friend's parents' house.
It's a very large log cabin in the woods. It has really high cathedral ceilings and balconies and then low ceilings in the kitchen, so there were a lot of sonic options for recording. I think we spent an entire day just setting up and placing band members in the room to record, and then a couple days of tracking, and then a couple weeks or maybe month of vocals and keys and kind of doing overdubs and things like that.
Almost all of the instruments are tracked live. We did some doubling, and that's something we wanted to keep, was this very live, real sound, and kind of bring the people into this space that we were in.
The longer you push, dear, the harder I fall. If you come close, I'll have to go.
Sweet Sarrow. I spoke with Maryland Morning producer Jonna McCone about their new self-titled EP. You can catch their next show at the Mobtown Ballroom in Baltimore on January 16th. We're looking for more musicians to profile here on Maryland Morning. If you've got suggestions for folks that we can feature, drop us a note at mdmorning@wipr.org, send us a tweet at Maryland Morning, or give us a call at 410-881-3162. We've got a link to more music by Sweet Sarrow at our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. For Nathan Sterner, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you Wednesday. Have a great day. Yeah.